In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Al Kemp, on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine. Shine your shoes anyway.
Home Permanent presents.
This is Nora Drake.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889.
Gee, Dick, why so gloomy?
Oh, same as usual, Mary. Money problems. It seems my pay is just swallowed up by monthly payments. On top of all this, I need 4 new tires for the buggy. I just don't know how I'll be able to afford them.
Why don't you do what our neighbors did? Trot on down to the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank and talk to Bill Karras, their family credit manager. You know, he granted them a consolidation loan, which they repay in low monthly payments at lower interest rates than they've been paying on other loans. Their monthly bills were cut in half, and for the first time in their lives, they're saving money.
Bill Karras, huh? A Burritt Mutual Savings Bank?
Mm-hmm, that's right. They've helped thousands of people like them. You'll be surprised to see how easy it is to arrange a loan.
By the way, Mary, what does Bill Karras do when he needs money?
I don't know. I guess he asks his wife, Nellie.
Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, New Britain, West Hartford, Wethersfield, Rocky Hill.
And now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is the man with 2,000 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Good evening, Ed.
Hi, Dick. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine, and I'm very excited about our guest tonight, charming and petite, but a giant among radio actresses.
Well, not only a famous actress, but she has written at least one bestseller, and she's currently on a lecture tour about her experiences. I'm speaking of Mary Jane Higbee.
Mary Jane Higbee, author of Tune In Tomorrow. And Mary Jane, you were the queen of soap opera actresses, weren't you?
Well, I think there are several girls that would dispute that. I don't want to find poison in my tea in the morning. No, I would think that Anne Elsner as Stella Dallas was a strong contender for the title, and Julie Stevens as Helen Trent, also our gal Sunday, Vivian Smolin. But I will say that When a Girl Marries did hold the highest rating for 5 consecutive years. It was during the war years. We went on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on NBC, and it was a very popular time and a very popular show during that period. It lasted 18 years.
I believe, yes, until about 1959.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you were on all but one network. You were with NBC, ABC, and CBS with that particular show.
With that particular show. I played on all the networks in other shows, you
I'm
see,
sure
because
you
we all
did
6 or 7 a day.
Mary Jane, you're on a lecture circuit now. Tell me about it.
Well, it's a very fascinating thing. I received a request from the school librarians of the state of California to address their convention around Christmas time, and there were 1,000 of them present and in San Francisco at the St. Francis Hotel, and this gave me the idea that a lecture tour would be a popular thing. So I approached Robert Kiedick, who is the oldest lecture bureau in the country, and showed him the letter from California requesting me, and gave him a copy of my book, and he said, oh, yes, indeed. And it's been fun. It's been one of the most stimulating things I've ever done, because in St. Paul last month, there were 3,500 people there. And, you know, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I've addressed many more, as we are now, undoubtedly, but you don't feel it. I feel here, and I've always felt this way, that there are 4 people in this room, you and the engineer, and myself. And I know somebody will listen to this, but it never seems quite real to me.
I'm
but
afraid
there,
that
when
did.
You're looking at them, if it did, we'd faint.
That's right.
We'd just faint. If I realized
so
how many people would hear us, well, that would be it. You'd carry on by yourselves.
Let's begin with the very early years. Ed, where does Mary Jane's start occur?
I believe you started, what, NBC in New York? Was that where you came from?
No, I started in California.
California.
I was brought up in Hollywood because my father was an actor, and he went out there for D.W. Griffith in films. I was just out of high school and playing in the theater out there in the stock company, and someone saw me and asked me if I wanted to do a radio show, and I sure did, because it was the Depression. You see, radio was, as we knew it then, that type of radio, was the entertainment form of the stay-at-home days of the Depression.
That's
and the
right.
Gas ration days of the Second World War.
So true. Let's go back to Hollywood. You weren't with the network at first, and we might talk about some of those fantastic salaries that you managed to corner back there in 1932, 1933.
Oh, yeah. Yes. The first job I had paid me $7, and I think that covered several cities, that program, and it was half an hour long, and we rehearsed 2 days for it, and I was so happy to see that $7. I cannot tell you, because really, no one who hasn't lived through it knows what it is to go through a depression like that, because you're not only broke yourself, but you don't know anybody who isn't. There's nothing to lean on. It's a little like an earthquake. We used to have those, too, quite frequently in Hollywood. And when I remember being on roller skates once in an earthquake, and there's just nothing to grab. You see, if you grab a post, the post is shaking. There's no place to look, and it was that way in the Depression. So that $7 came in like, it was like the Marines, you know. I didn't knock it at all.
Be a payday saver at the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Come into any office of Burritt on any day of the month and meet a select group of savers, the payday savers, businessmen, tradesmen, professional people, career girls, and even mothers who save from the grocery money. Why do these people all stop in at the Big B? To save on a regular and very profitable basis. A payday saver is a regular saver, one who knows that through a systematic plan of savings, he'll be able to pay for that college education, new home, or retirement trip. At the Burritt, the payday saver receives 5% on a regular account with interest from day of deposit to day of withdrawal, 6% on 2-year certificates of deposit, 5.75% on 1-year certificates, and 5.75% on 90-day notice accounts. Join your friends at the sign of the Big B, the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, and become a payday saver.
When a girl marries. Walter Baker Chocolate Products, favorites with the homemakers of America for nearly 200 years, present When a Girl Marries. This tender, human story of young married life is dedicated to everyone who has ever been in love. But now, to many of you ladies who listen to When a Girl Marries every day, Walter Baker's fine chocolates and cocoa are old and valued friends. Probably your mothers, your grandmothers, and their grandmothers use Baker's Premium Number 1 Chocolate and Baker's Breakfast Cocoa regularly. For Baker's Chocolate came into being nearly 200 years ago in the little New England town of Dorchester, Massachusetts, where it is still being produced. You see, Baker's Chocolates and Cocoa are milled from carefully selected rare flavored cocoa beans gathered in Central and South American tropics and the Caribbean islands. Skilled craftsmen handle the blending and roasting, the pressing to silken smoothness to bring you the very finest chocolates and cocoa that money can buy. So when you want to make anything with chocolate or cocoa, it's wise to remember to use Baker's. And now, When a Girl Marries, the story of Joan and Harry Davis. Earlier this evening, Harry discovered that his car had broken down and the return trip to Beechwood would be impossible until the morning. Even though his speech was a great success, the idea of leaving Joan alone in the old farmhouse is a constant worry. But Betty, realizing fate has played into her hands, is doing her best to cheer Harry, to take advantage of being alone with him. Now, as we begin our story,
oh, phone. It's ringing. Oh, it's too cold to get up. I can't get up. I just can't. Like ice in this room. Oh, all right, all right. What did you have to call so late for? Oh, where's my robe? Slippers. Oh, I can't light the light. I can't, that's all. Yes, I'm coming, I'm coming. Oh, it's so cold. Hello?
Joan, thank God you've answered. Are you all right?
Yes, I guess so, but I'm awfully cold.
Were you asleep?
Yes, but I'll be awake in a minute. Oh, Harry, the furnace went out.
But you're all right?
Yes, or I will be once I'm warm again.
You called me, darling.
Oh, yes, long ago, to ask you how to start the furnace.
Did you get Irma over there?
No, only Sammy and me. There's nobody else here.
And the furnace has gone out?
Yes, I tried to start it, but I don't know about drafts and things.
Well, look, Joan, I'll be there as fast as I can get there in the morning.
All right, Harry.
You stay in bed as late as you can, and I'll attend to everything about the furnace when I get there. How's Sammy?
He's asleep in our bed. I took him in with me. I was afraid to sleep alone.
I'm glad you've got him there with you. Now listen, darling, don't worry about a thing. I'll get there the minute I can. You stay tucked up in bed until I do, you understand?
Yes.
All right then, darling. I won't worry too much about you.
Harry.
Yes, what is it?
I...
What's the matter?
I don't know,
What do you mean you don't know? What made you cry out like that?
Something. It's dark here. I haven't got a light.
Something. What? Why can't you say what it is? What's the matter, Joan?
An awfully cold breeze suddenly.
As if what, Joan? What are you talking about?
While I was standing here talking to you, a cold wind swept through the house.
You said the furnace was out.
Not like that.
Like what? Can't you say like what?
As if a door was open. Or a window, or...
Have you got any windows open?
No.
Well, then, where could the breeze come from?
I don't know. It's not blowing now. Oh, Harry, I'm frightened.
Frightened of what, Joan? There's nothing to be frightened of. You've got Sammy upstairs asleep, and I'll be there by morning.
There's somebody in this house.
Oh, no, darling, you're imagining things. You go along up the stairs to your room.
Harry, I heard something. I heard a sound. Harry.
Darling, there's nobody there. You only imagine.
Harry, what'll I do? I'm all alone.
Listen, darling, you're imagining things.
No. No, there is somebody in the house. He just knocked over something. Harry.
Joan, for heaven's sakes, don't ring off now. Now listen to what I tell you to do. You know where my revolver is?
No. Yes. Oh, Harry, what'll I do? He's in the house.
My revolver's in the desk drawer. It's loaded, Joan. Just go over and get it and come right back to the phone. Can you?
I don't know. I'm shaking so. My legs. Harry, I've got to get upstairs to Sammy.
No, Joan, listen to me. Do as I tell you. Do you hear any sounds now?
I don't know. Oh, Harry, why aren't you here?
Don't keep still a minute and listen. Do you hear any sounds now, Joan?
No. No. Yes. Yes, I heard something.
Joan, get that gun, will you? It's in the desk drawer.
I can't. I don't know where he is. I'm afraid. I don't know what to do.
Joan, I'll get somebody there in a minute. Only keep talking so I'll know you're all right. Keep talking, Joan.
I can't. I'm afraid. Oh, Harry. I heard it again. It's closer now. Harry. Harry.
Joan, for heaven's sake, speak to me. Joan, are you all right? Joan, listen to as I tell you. Joan. Joan. Joan, speak to me. Speak to me, Joan. She doesn't answer. She doesn't answer.
Well, that's quite a story. I'd like to know what happens next. That's an excerpt from When a Girl Marries, starring Mary Jane Higbee, going back about 30 years, I guess, to 1941. Mary Jane, what function do you feel that the radio serial played in the life of the average housewife?
I think what we supplied in the daytime serials, of which I did so many, And what is supplied today by the many daytime serials is only one thing, companionship. You know, when that husband leaves the house and the children go to school, that place is Siberia, right? Mm-hmm. And this friendly voice, and that was why, and still, you must have a technique for playing the leads on these things that wears well, because it's going to come into the home every day, and you can't sound shrewish.
Mm-hmm.
It required quite a definite technique.
Now, Hollywood was not the center for radio in the early 30s when you were working there.
No, it certainly wasn't, because there was no... telephone wires were not set up in a way that made it easy to broadcast from west to east, what they called the round robin, which I never understood or knew anything about till I started writing the book. And then I went to an engineer at NBC and said, look, why did it cost Eddie Cantor $1,200 more to broadcast from Hollywood than it did from New York? Because I'd found this out during research. And he said, well, it was the round robin, dear. And then he explained to me that that is the skein of telephone wires which form the network. Now, I had been speaking over those networks for like 30 years then, and I didn't know it. I think I had the idea that everything I said went right straight up to the roof and out and into the homes across the nation. I'd never really thought of it. But, of course, I knew the telephone company had something to do with it, but I didn't realize the extent that it, the important part it played. And it was in 1937 that they learned to reverse the channels so that they could broadcast directly from the coast. And then there was a great rush of shows from New York to Hollywood. Unfortunately, it was the year I selected to go from Hollywood to New York, but that has been the pattern of my whole life experience.
Do you know how being a preferred borrower at Barrett Mutual Savings Bank can help you? The other day, we asked a man who was waiting in the personal loan department if this was the first time that he had applied for a loan at the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank. No, he said. It was actually the fourth. Why had he come back to the Barrett? Barrett was his bank. The loan officers were friendly and sympathetic to his needs, and they were willing to take the time to discuss his financial problems and help him. The rates are lower, he said. Monthly payments are convenient, and once he had established credit at the Barrett, he had become a preferred borrower, and his loans got top priority. Sound like a position you would like to be in? If so, drop in at any one of the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank's four convenient offices. You, too, may become a preferred Barrett borrower. The long-term benefits are tremendous.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio. Brought to you by Barrett Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. This is WTIC Radio in Hartford, Connecticut.
Now, the story of your moving to New York, I think, is a fascinating one, because people all during your developing days in Hollywood were telling you that this was indeed the Mecca for radio.
Yes.
And so in 1937, you decided to do something about it.
I decided to come east. It was the creative center. It still is, in essence, where the real spark of the thing starts, I think. There's a great activity takes place on the coast because they had such a vast pool of people there with big names, you see. And I never regretted going to New York, because what I was doing out there was making about as much money as anybody was, I think, which was about $100 a week if you broke your neck. And half-hour show would pay you $25 or $30, and then Lux came along. And that was the first one that paid, well, Mary Pickford's first show for Royal Gelatin, and then Lux, paid $50 for an hour show, but you had to rehearse 2 or 3 days, and the studios were so far apart. They were all a 30-minute drive by car, so you couldn't have conflicts. It was very hard. I remember turning down Cantor several times because I had Lux, and you just couldn't work them out. And it's where you might be called for something that would take you up to a fee of $200 or $300. You couldn't always do it because you wouldn't. Mm-hmm. The time was used up. Now, in New York, things were more centrally located. There was a small radius there of the networks that you could get to them within a very few minutes. And then there was the great blessing of soap opera, of which we had none on the coast. Now, soap opera was great for women. There were a lot of women's parts. And you know, from time immemorial, in the theater, in films, every place, the majority of parts are for men. Just look at any Shakespearean play, for example, and you'll see 3 or 4 women and 18, 20 men. But soap opera was just the reverse. There was the leading lady and her antagonist, the villainess, and they each had a confidante, and they were all women, you see. And then there was the dear old loving mother and the evil stepmother and this sort of stuff. And you could really, any woman who was really very, very good could probably do 4 or 5 shows a day because we didn't have to memorize anything. We read it all from the script. And many were doing as much as 7 during a day, 7 soap operas. And you could also rehearse at night for a night show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's in your book you mentioned, and this is something I think is worth repeating for our radio audience, that why these people appeared was because they were good, because all these parts were auditioned for.
Oh, yes.
And yet the same people kept getting them all the time. So they were very, very skilled people, weren't they, that were doing
these
things?
Yes, and it was very difficult for a newcomer to break in because it required certain things that it took you a little while to learn. You really had to be very skillful. It's a skill that is no longer needed, unfortunately. But there was the painting of a picture quickly with the sound of your voice. I mean the sound of someone carrying a heavy object or riding horseback outdoors and calling to the other person. And there was working in close sort of communion with the sound man, so that the sound man and you were doing exactly the same thing at the same time. And it was interesting. I mean, the sound of well, I guess I'll get up now. You see, you wouldn't do that.
And he'd slide the chair.
That's right, and he'd slide the chair.
Yeah. Can we go back to the Shell Chateau? That was a show that you were on, I believe, before you left for New York.
Yes, that was the first network show I ever did, and then I used to appear on it quite often. I would say I've appeared on that about once a month. Originally, it was just the Pacific Coast Network, and I did it with Eddie Horton and Edward Everett Horton, who was one of the most skillful comedians that ever lived. The first broadcast I did for them, we did from the Pomona Fair. Now, I have never understood why radio felt that it would enhance the value of a vaudeville show, for example, and that's in essence what it was, to take it out to the world's, to a fairground, and do a remote, because it didn't add a thing.
There were some fascinating stories in the book, as I recall, about great stars who became panic-stricken when faced with that mic. I think perhaps
Victor McLaglen, I remember. I was not on the show that day, but it shook everybody who was terribly. He got halfway through a show, and he had been essentially a silent movie actor, you know. And in making a talking film, you can take a lot of time and do things over. Radio was do it now because everything was live. Mm-hmm. Nothing could be edited, and it was a very scary business for some of these people. And in the middle of it, he just uttered an oath, threw down the script, and said, "I can't do this thing," and walked away. And the radio actors had to finish out the last 10 minutes by themselves. They told what he would have said if he had been there, and they worked it out that way. I did that once with a program where someone dropped the script, and I just said, my first line was, "You remember Lola?" And the person said, "Lola, Lola, Lola," and I looked up and saw that he had no script. So I said, "Now, you must remember Lola, because you met her yesterday." His line was, "Oh, yes, I met her yesterday at the railroad station." I said, "You met her yesterday at the railroad station, and she said to you, and you said to her, and I think your forthcoming attitude is going to be," and I went on and for about 2 pages, till he got himself to get his script together again.
That's a beautiful experience. I think the interesting aspect of the salaries that you were quoting is the tremendous disparity in salaries between the veteran radio actor and the headliner, who might receive a very fine salary for a radio performance, and this is what brought about the union.
Yes, that and a lot of unhappy situations. The great name bands had been made by radio, and they were an important part of entertainment those days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And bringing in thousands of dollars every week. And the radio people, the networks notably, said, "We are making these people. We should manage them, and we should have our own sort of casting bureau to handle this." And they did, and that was valid, I think. But when these casting bureaus were set up, automatically, they became agents, and 10% of any of the artists that worked on the networks was taken by that artist bureau. And even if you did a $5 job in California on network, you'd get $4.50, you see. Well,
and 50 cents would go back to the network.
That was never aimed at the people who were making $5. That just happened. And no one noticed it until they formed a union to bring it to people's attention. And then they quickly rectified it. I don't think that it had ever been That had never been the basic intention.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other things that were... We would be called as actors to sit around by some kooky director while he fiddled with sound effects maybe for a whole day. In the meantime, you're losing that other show that would have paid you $30 that you badly needed mm-hmm. at the time while you sit here and you're not doing anything. And they all felt that they couldn't get to a thing unless we had that sort of arrangement that the whole show would fall apart. Well, they learned to allocate their time in about a week. And it worked out very, very well. So that was really the basis for the union. I will never say that we were ever very downtrodden. It wasn't that at all. It was in a period of great depression. It was an area of great security for the artists involved. It was a security nothing else offered. And I don't think anyone ever lost sight of that. But they wanted to make certain changes, and you usually have to band together in order to make them, unfortunately.
When looking for that new car, may we suggest that you come to Burritt Mutual Savings Bank? No, the Big B does not sell new or used cars, but it does help people to buy them. Chances are that you didn't know that Burritt Mutual Savings Bank will make you a car loan at low, low rates. Before buying that new car, call any one of our four convenient offices for information. But wait, that's not all. You'll need another car when this one wears out, and the Big B has a plan for that, too. When you finish with your new car loan, keep on making the payments into a Burritt Mutual Savings account where you'll earn big, big dividends with no effort at all. Savings rates range from 5 to 6% depending on the plan you choose. But whatever the plan, the next car you buy will be paid for by your Burritt Mutual Passbook. So don't wait. Drop in at any office of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank for your new car loan or to make that monthly payment on your old car loan. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Let's talk about some of the unusual people with whom you worked. I'm thinking particularly of the sound effects man on Renfrew of the Mountain. Can you tell me about it?
It wasn't the sound man. The sound man was Keene Crockett, who was one of the greatest sound men that ever lived and one of the funniest men. But it was the man who imitated the sound of the timber wolf.
Mm-hmm.
That was the interesting thing about this is that everything we did was live. We were never allowed to use any recorded effects. Therefore, he couldn't just record that wolf effect. He had to go there every day and provide the signature. You remember, House Jameson used to say, Renfrew of the Mounted. And then House himself, for some reason, I don't know why the sound man didn't do this, but he didn't. He would march, and you'd hear the sound of his marching feet. He's announced himself, now he's marching for himself. And then he would say, Renfrew reporting. He reported to himself. And then my friend, whose name was Brad Barker, would go, "Ow!" And this was the opening of Renfrew. It was a great thing, this thing of having to do things live. I had a friend, Mrs. Frank Lovejoy, and Joan Banks was her name in those days, and she had a commercial that she had to do at NBC. And it was Saturday night at midnight. And she had one line. The announcer read a one-minute spiel, and Joni had to come in and say, "I always use Dreen shampoo." Well, she was at a party one night, and she said, "Ooh, my commercial." She ran down and jumped into a taxi and off to NBC and up to the 8th floor and up to the microphone, and the announcer read a perfect one-minute piece of copy, and she said, "I always use Dreen shampoo." That was Saturday night. Well, Sunday, she got a wire from the sponsor saying, "We feel you've done this commercial too long." Isn't that great? I didn't know that when I wrote the book. She told me about it later. I've learned a lot of things since I wrote the book. Actors have come to me, and I said, "Now you tell me. Why did you tell me then?"
I enjoyed the story particularly about you strapping yourself into the chair prior to a broadcast. Would you relate that story for us?
It was the first broadcast I did of When a Girl Marries, and I was extremely nervous because I wanted that job desperately. It was the first contract I ever had, and it meant an enormous amount to me because it meant a security I knew about. I had been secure in the past 5 years, but I never knew it, because every week you were thinking, "Now, will I be called again next week?" But I always was. But now I would have a contract with my name on it and somebody else's name on it, and I would be permanently engaged. So I was shaking all over. And Ken McGregor had made a strong fight to put me on the show against someone in the advertising agency who just happened not to like me or my work. He didn't know me personally. And I had finally achieved this, so I was terribly nervous, and I had a suit jacket on with a large belt buckle, and I sat down in a folding chair and kept my nose buried in that script and worked every second. I was keyed up to the nth degree. Then when I tried to get up, I found that I was tied to the chair, this belt buckle. I couldn't figure out what it was. My icy fingers wouldn't disentangle me. And I saw the panicky look on the announcer's face because he'd ended his narration. And the sound man rushed over to me, and he realized he couldn't get me out of this position, so he just picked up this chair and carried the chair over to the microphone and held it.
What did they view? Well,
and somebody else, I guess the announcer came around. It was Frank Gallup then. Frank came around, and they worked together and got the buckle out and finally took the chair away. And I played that whole scene with someone holding a chair up against my seat.
But fortunately, you didn't, or no one saw the humor in it at that particular moment, so you were
it
able to maintain your composure.
It wasn't funny to me, believe me.
Right.
It was a terrifying thing. It was just dreadful. It was the longest broadcast of my whole life.
Well, I think that I wish we had an excerpt from that show, but we don't, Mary Jane. We're going to take you up to the 50s now, the late 50s, for one of your shows. It's interesting, I think, too, to note that in the late 50s, the techniques were more sophisticated. The characterizations were well-written and well-acted. This is one of your last shows.
This is Nora Drake.
Is Nora Drake, a modern story seen through the window of a woman's heart. This is Nora Drake, written by Julian Funk. In her 6 years at the Page Memorial Hospital, Nora Drake has come into contact with a great many patients. And though to all of them she has given of her time, her skill, her gentle warmth and sympathy, most of them, as they passed through her ward, remained only names on a medical chart. Which is, of course, as it should be. But one patient, Bob Keating, did get under her skin. Not that she fell in love with Bob, far from it. She's still in love with Dr. Ken Martinson, who broke their engagement many months ago and married wealthy Peggy King instead. No, Nora isn't in love with Bob, but somehow, being Nora, she can't help being drawn toward him. For despite his cynicism, his bitterness, his sardonic manner, she knows that this is just a mask, that beneath it he's like a little boy who's easily hurt, who yearns for love, for sympathy and understanding. Well, he's back once more as a patient. And Dr. Victor Jensen, medical director of the hospital and a good friend of Bob's, has just come in to pay him a visit.
Good morning, Bob. You feel any better?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. I was able to get some sleep anyway.
Good. And how about the pain? Letting up any?
A little.
Well, you just... Bob, what's this doing here?
What's what doing where?
These pills. Weren't you supposed to take them at 8 o'clock?
Oh, they're the wrong shade, Doctor. There's one color I can't stand in pills. It's green.
Bob, this won't do.
You're telling me?
No, you're still pretty low, eh, Bob?
Who, me? Of course not. I'm full of bounce and ebullience and joie de vivre. Low? I'm right on top of the very pinnacle, I am.
Well, you'll be leaving here in a few days or a week at most, and then you'll feel a lot better about things.
What things?
Come in.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Nora. Come on in.
Hello, Bob.
Well, I sure get plenty of attention around here anyway.
And don't you love it? How's he getting along, Doctor?
I was just telling him he'll probably be out of here in a week.
Oh. Is that soon enough for you, Nora?
No, I'm disappointed. I thought we'd be having your company for a lot longer.
Well, you may as well, Nora, if he keeps fighting off treatment.
All right, Doctor, if it'll make you feel any better, I'll take those pills.
They won't make me feel any better, Bob. They might help you, though.
All right. But I still don't like green.
I'll try to remember that. Oh, by the way, Nora, I found out what happened when you tried to call me yesterday. I told the operator that I was leaving the office for a few minutes, and she thought I'd said the building. That's why she told you I wasn't in. When Peggy Martinson called me, there was a new operator on duty, and she connected her right away.
I see. Peggy Martinson was sure that I hadn't even tried to reach you. That Ken was the first one I called when Bob got sick.
Well, don't be too hard on her. She's got her problems.
I don't doubt that for a minute. But this is the first time I've heard you express any sympathy towards her.
I'm softening up.
Good. Glad to hear it.
Well, I've got to get back to the office. I'll see you both later.
Right, Doctor.
I thought you have charge of an entire ward, Nora. Haven't you got things to do?
Lots of things. Don't worry, Bob. I won't stay more than a few minutes.
You've stayed too long already. Why do you bother, Nora? Why do you spend all this time with me?
Aren't you exaggerating a little?
All right, why do you spend any time? Is it a form of penance? You feel obliged to torture yourself?
No, I don't, Bob. But I know someone who does. Bob, why must you always put up such a struggle? Don't you want me to come around anymore?
I can do without your pity, Nora.
Pity?
Is there anything else? Nora, why don't you put me out of my agony? It's quite simple, you know. All you have to do is take Ken Martinson back, and I'll stop hoping. I know I have nothing to hope for, really, but as long as you say no to him, I keep hoping anyway.
That's the only way I can put you out of your misery is to take Ken Martinson back. I'm afraid you're going to be miserable for a long time. But I can offer you my friendship, Bob. I hope you can settle for that, because it's all I can offer you.
And now let's go on to the Martinsons' apartment. Ken has just come into the kitchen.
All set for breakfast, darling?
Just some coffee, that's all, Peg.
All right. Here you are.
Thanks.
Don't you feel well, Ken?
I feel all right.
Quite a wild night, wasn't it?
Was it?
You're still angry with me, darling. I suppose I shouldn't have followed you last night, but Nora's calling you did sort of intrigue me. And besides, Bob is a cousin of mine.
Yes, you explained all that last night. I quite understand. It wasn't jealousy, of course. You were just concerned about Bob Keith.
If that's sarcasm, darling, it isn't quite in order, you know. Have you forgotten what happened, Ken? Or do you still believe that story about her trying to get Dr. Jensen?
I don't care to talk about it.
No, I wouldn't either if I were you. All right, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about all the time I have on my hands and what good use I could put it to by becoming a volunteer nurse at Page Memorial.
I thought you'd given up that idea.
Thought, darling, or hope?
Well, I still don't like it.
Why not?
I told you why.
You mean that nonsense about husband and wife working together?
It isn't nonsense.
I wonder if you'd feel that way if Nora Drake didn't happen to work there also.
Mrs. Martinson, delighted to see you.
It's so nice of you to say so.
You haven't been around in a long time. Were you looking for your husband?
No. Not today.
Oh, did you come to annoy Nora?
I deserve that on the basis of past performance. If I've been a nuisance, Miss Fuller, please accept my apologies.
They're accepted. What can I do for you?
I understand the hospital can use volunteer nurses. Is that right?
Yes. Matter of fact, why do you ask?
I'd like to volunteer.
You? Are you serious?
Grimly serious.
Well, does your husband know about this?
Why? Do I have to have his permission?
No, but I...
But what?
Well, we get quite a few volunteers, Mrs. Martinson. Some of them don't last very long. They get bored very quickly. You know what I mean?
I don't doubt it.
Are you sure that's the sort of work you want to do?
Look, Miss Fuller, I would like to be a volunteer. Are you or are you not accepting my offer?
I'll have to think it over.
All right, think it over. But don't take too long. And whatever you do, Miss Fuller, don't turn me down because I happen not to be one of your favorite people. That would be a mistake. So unless you can dig up a very good official reason for rejecting me, you'd better not try. Because if you do, I'll kick up one terrible row. I don't care who it embarrasses either. And I'm just the girl to do it.
Peggy Martinson is the last person whom Rose Fuller would like to see around the hospital. But she knows that the threat Peggy just made isn't an idle one, that she would indeed cause a great deal of trouble if Rose turns her down. Of course, what Rose doesn't know is that no matter what she decides to do, there's trouble ahead, and much more than either of them bargained for. Be sure to listen tomorrow to another exciting episode of This is Nora Drake. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And some rather amusing things would happen during the course of a live soap opera that would cause you or some of the actors at any rate to break up, as we say.
Oh, yes. Of course, all of the great bloopers that you hear about took place in radio. You don't hear about them in television very much. And that is because everything was live on network. Mm-hmm. And once you had said it, it was gone. It was like I always use Drune Shampoo. Once she said it, she couldn't get it back. It was there forever. And we had one on When a Girl Marries, of course, where the whole show just went to pieces. And that was when Rosemary Rice, who was the ingenue, stepped up and said, I'm worried about, and there's some argument about what she said. She said, I'm worried about the potato crepe. And what she wanted to say was potato crop. And Ann Burr came back with, oh, well, what's the matter with the potato crop? And Rosemary said, well, I don't know. It seems to be some kind of disease. And my husband, oh, my poor husband. He's put his all in potatoes. Well, we went on like that, and it was a sort of snowballing gag because it happened that the show itself was so sad that day, and they were saying things like, oh, poor Joan. The doctor says her baby won't live through the night.
Yeah, that is funny.
It was terribly funny. And I wasn't at the microphone at the time, and I was horrified. And I thought, oh, this is my show. I've got to pull this thing together. I can't let this go on. So it was time for me to go on. And I thought, well, I mustn't look at them. And I couldn't look in the control booth because everybody in the control booth was in convulsions. The director had just thrown the script in the air and had his head in his arms, and I could see his shoulders shaking. And the girls at the microphone had these red convulsive faces. So I averted my eyes and I went up to the microphone and I said, girls, I have terrible news. And I heard one of them say, oh, what is it? And I said, Harry's in jail.
Oh, marvelous.
Crazy, yes.
Have you ever heard of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank and wondered where it got its name? If so, you may be interested in this explanation. The Burritt is in recognition of one of this area's most noteworthy citizens of the 1800s, Mr. Elihu Burritt, the learned blacksmith. Elihu Burritt was a self-taught linguist, a patriot, and peace emissary who served his country here and abroad. The mutual came from the fact that the bank is owned by and operated for its depositors. There are no stockholders in the bank. Established in 1889, the bank has served generations of depositors and borrowers in central Connecticut and is today a large, strong, and successful institution. When you save at Burritt, you commemorate the glorious past, profit from the successful present, and share in the promise of an eventful future. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, a proud mutual savings bank with offices in New Britain, West Hartford, and Rocky Hill.
Let's recall the days of Air Features, Frank and Ann Hummert. Now, this really was the epitome of the soap opera, wasn't it? This team and this organization that built these shows.
They and Erna Phillips, who was another completely separate person, they all came from Chicago. They were the two strongest influences. Erna Phillips created her shows. I think the first one went on as early as 1930. It may have been the first soap opera. I'm not sure it wasn't. It was called Painted Dreams. And she retired last year. Mm. And there are, I think, five that she created still running on television today, including The Guiding Light, which is now 35 years old, including its radio and television period, you see. And Charita Bauer, who started out as an ingenue in that, is now playing the grandmother, Mrs. Bauer.
That's beautiful.
Yes, it's fascinating. There are two people on that who were there in the very, very early days. Now, the Hummerts, they created a different sort of show. Their shows, I think, had more influence in the beginning, but Erna Phillips obviously lasted longer because they're still going. She had a way of plotting, Erna Phillips did, with many different plots running, and that's what's being used today on television. You have what's happening to one daughter and what's happening to the husband of the other daughter, and these are all interwoven, mm-hmm. and one day one of those plots may not appear at all. And it's a very good thing for television because the actors don't have to turn up every day, and they couldn't possibly learn five every day forever and ever and ever, five a week, you see. And so that format was great for television. Now, that was the exact opposite of what the Hummert shows were. The Hummert shows were Stella Dallas, Helen Trent. The Hummerts accounted for about 30% of all radio programming during one period in the late 30s. And their soap operas were done in sequences. They would have a sharp 13-week definition and start a new story with the same main characters. A group of malefactors would come into the life of, let us say, just plain Bill the Barber of Hartville. And they'd make trouble for him, and he would overcome them, and he would conquer all, he and his daughter. And then they'd all disappear, and the next Monday a whole new group would come in. The Hummerts were wonderful, wonderful people. They had It was a great factory of soap operas. They had so many of them going. And they I think, perhaps invented, at least they used the giveaway, which was not exactly a giveaway. We called it that, but it was taken from that child thing where the children's program would say, send in a box,
right.
Premium. Mm-hmm. And I remember the one on Helen Trent that we did for a long, long time when I played Cynthia, the villainess on Helen Trent. And it was a piece of costume jewelry that was a lovebird pin. And the announcer, Field and Farrington, used to say, with real simulated gold flashing. Now, if that isn't the most bogus piece of promotion you've ever heard in your life. And we'd stop right in the middle of the show. And no matter if Helen and I were having practically a fist fight, I'd stop suddenly and say, Helen, what a beautiful pin you're wearing. It's, oh, yes, this is my lovebird pin with the real simulated gold flashing. You know?
That's wonderful. In 1948, you, I believe, were one of the first people to realize that television was suddenly going to change radio broadcasting.
I was certain that television was going to. I guess it was 1938 when they had the New York World's Fair, and I mm-hmm. saw television. I thought, oh, baby, here it comes. I knew this was too good to last. I knew all this beautiful security was blown. So I lived on borrowed time for the next 20 years without a free moment. I was waiting for that monster with that one eye to turn up, and it did. It got me in the end, although I enjoy it very much. I've done a few talk shows and things like that, and it's fun. I wouldn't want to do a soap on it. We used to have things burned down. I remember a giant forest fire I was caught in one time, and I was kidnapped and went in an old truck, rattled over. Well, this is for movies. You couldn't, movies and radio.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it with a medium that is essentially a static, as television really is. If they'd shut off the sound, they wouldn't realize that what they're seeing is people talking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were slow enough, but we did things. Of course, the soap operas presented a ridiculous problem about narration, and that is that some of the sponsors wanted a recap that would go on and cover the entire plot. Well, now you keep a show on the air for 10 years, and I don't care how slowly it's moving, some things are going to happen
yeah.
that you can't get into one page of narration, you know? And I remember one from Mary Marlin, and I carried it around in my purse. I was on Mary Marlin for 3 or 4 years. The story of Mary Marlin, that's it. Mary ponders the strange fate that has revealed to her the fact that Joe may still be alive, while Joe himself in Freedom Outpost is reminded by Simone of the love he once had for Mary, of how he could love her still if he had not put her out of his life, or of how he could love someone like her, like Simone, while up on the hill Mr. Crayley looks upon the whole thing as an invasion of his privacy. Isn't that divine?
That's great.
That's an author really working to get it all in.
When you look into the future for your children, what frightens you the most? The cost of a college education? Right. Well, there's nothing you can do about the rising cost of education, but you can provide for your children by saving. There are several plans open to you at the Big B, the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. The first, a regular savings account, paying 5% from day of deposit to day of withdrawal, with interest compounded monthly. The second, a 6% certificate of deposit. Third, a 5.75% certificate. And fourth, a 5.25% 90-day notice account. If you save a portion of your pay each payday, you'll be pleasantly surprised at the handsome sum you will accumulate over the years. Don't wait. Stop in at any one of Burritt Mutual Savings Bank's 4 convenient offices and add to your existing account or open your new account today.
Mary Jane, would you like to go back to those days?
You mean a world war and depression?
Oh, you see, now you're remembering the realities of those
no,
years.
No, we had too many soap operas on the air. I don't think we need all that back again. No.
I think that radio as it stands today is better than it's ever been. I like radio. I listen more than I ever used to. To me, there's some stunning and great things on the air now.
Well, that's true. I wonder from the standpoint of an actress, though, whether it wasn't a better time. Certainly, there is no opportunity for actors and actresses in radio today.
But absolutely
not. It was certainly an experimental, a creative time. The business seems to have pretty much settled down today, don't you feel?
Well, I think that there are certain things. For instance, NBC had Brad Crandall doing that extraordinary show for so long. To me, that was a much more stunning achievement for one man to carry
marvelous,
in his thought
marvelous
the knowledge
job
that man had than it was to have something like Information Please, which was planned.
Scripted.
And set, you see. And it's a much more flexible, fluent medium now. There's less pretense connected with it. It's more, it levels more. The cards are on the table.
Well, Mary Jane, I think there's good news for our audience. Your book, Tune In Tomorrow, is now in paperback. I would very much recommend it because it's not only filled with some of the stories, but the pictures are just excellent. I don't think I've seen a better collection of some of the personalities that you have put together for this. And anybody who likes radio ought to buy this book. It's really wonderful. And who's publishing it in paperback?
Ace.
And it is on the newsstands now?
Oh, yes.
Well, I wish everybody would buy it. I think it's really a wonderful book, and anybody
well,
who likes the
subject,
it's a great thing to have in your library.
Thank you so much for being our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. It's been such fun.
Thank you.
And now, until next time, this is Dick Bertel for Ed Corcoran. Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. The program was engineered by Bob Sherrago and was produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Al Terzi.
Stop a while, let a song be your style. Use dish shampoo. Don't despair, use your head, save your hair. Use dish shampoo.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Kamay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse-o white and rinse-o bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and
a dancing program from the Paradise Restaurant in the Great White Way of Manhattan, New York City. Played by Glenn Miller and his office.